At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And future stronger you can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See home club for details.
Let's find a conversation between the soul. Let's find a conversation between the soul and the night.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, please check out our YouTube station. Please join our Discord, and to do that, you've got to subscribe, so please subscribe. Derek, let's just get right into it, and let's talk about this U.S.-Russia meeting in Riyadh.
As had been expected, a team of U.S. and Russian negotiators led respectively by Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, and Sergei Lavrov, the Russian Foreign Minister, met in Saudi Arabia on Tuesday, supposedly to lay the groundwork for ending the war in Ukraine. Ukraine was not invited to the meeting. I'm sorry. I just find that morbidly hilarious. I don't know how much progress they actually made on this. This was the headline item on the agenda, was to get the ball rolling on Ukrainian peace talks. All it seems that they agreed to do was to appoint other teams, more technical teams, but high level, supposedly, to begin the process of actually negotiating a peace deal. It's unclear when that appointment process is supposed to take place, or when it's supposed to be over, or when the actual peace talks are supposed to happen. So this was really more an agreement in principle to begin negotiations rather than any substantive negotiation. Substantively, they did agree on normalizing U.S. and Russian diplomatic relations, which have not, they haven't frayed completely. They still have, you know, still have respective ambassadors in each other's countries. But since the Russian invasion in 2022, they've been subject to a series of restrictions on both sides in terms of staffing levels at various embassies, consulates, etc. You know, I think there have been other restrictions on activities, movement of the various diplomatic teams. So they agreed to kind of put that in the past and work toward normalizing the operations of those diplomatic missions. They also apparently talked about all the possible investment opportunities for American businesses in Russia if the sanctions go away and the U.S. is allowed to begin operating, or U.S. companies are allowed to begin operating in Russia again, which I'm sure was an appeal directly at Donald Trump.
Well, not only U.S. companies, Derek, other individuals will perhaps be allowed to operate within Russia as well.
So. Well, we can only hope. I mean, I assume that you'll be hot, top priority on the list to have your sanctions revoked. But, you know, I think, you know, President Deals was certainly listening to the message here that there's money to be made by investing, reinvesting in Russia. That's, I think, to counter his dreams of making hundreds of billions of dollars off of Ukrainian minerals, which we can talk about in a moment. That's a separate, somewhat separate issue. But the meeting did take place. We're going to see some additional interactions. The main aftermath, we can talk about the Zelensky and Trump feud if you want. That's really where things have gone. Yeah, so... Zelensky was not happy, needless to say, about being cut out of this meeting. You can sort of understand why. It's a meeting that has direct impact on Ukraine's future. He's the president of Ukraine, and he wasn't invited to participate. There is a growing fear that after, I think we've talked about this, after, you know, sort of a lot of clenching and white knuckling during the meat of last year's presidential campaign on the part of Europeans, Ukrainians about Trump, and he's talking about ending the war in 24 hours, which would, you know, presumably have just been a capitulation to Russia. Then, as we got closer to the election, a little bit after the election, Trump and his team were talking about you know, it's going to be 6 months. We have to do some heavy negotiations. We're not looking for a bad deal. We want to get a good agreement to end the conflict. And, we'll probably keep supporting Ukraine militarily, et cetera, all these things while we're doing this. So I think people started to feel a little bit better. Now we're back to Trump is just selling the store to the Russians. And I think, you know, just the image of the U.S. taking over negotiations and cutting Ukraine out completely has caused a lot of consternation, nowhere more so than in Kyiv. So Zelensky, as I say, was quite unhappy. He was scheduled to make his own trip to Saudi Arabia. This had been on the books separately. He's doing a little tour of the Middle East right now. He had been scheduled, as I say, to visit Saudi Arabia this week after the U.S.-Russia talks, canceled that trip because he didn't want to give even the appearance of sort of a halo endorsement of what had taken place between the U.S. and Russia. So, and then had some pretty pointed comments about being cut out of the talks and you know, his displeasures, you know, unhappiness over that, to which Trump responded pretty vehemently. He was seemed pretty put out by this.
You know why I want? Because I don't want all these people killed anymore. And I think I have the power to end this war. And I think it's going very well. But today I heard, oh, well, we weren't invited. Well, you've been there for 3 years. You should have ended it 3 years. You should have never started it. You could have made a deal.
Tuesday evening after the talks had taken place in Riyadh, and Zelensky had articulated some of his disappointment, Trump criticized Zelensky for having started the war, which I think maybe is a bit of an overstatement. We've talked about, you know, some of the deeper
Lib
causes
Twitter
of
was
the
not
war.
Happy, Derek.
But Lib Twitter was not happy. And, you know, I mean, there is an invader and an invadee in this situation. And I think
absolutely
probably important to keep that in mind. But, you know, he criticized Zelensky for starting the war, called him a dictator, which is a reference to the fact that he, under martial law, canceled elections last year, in which he was supposed to run for re-election, claimed out of, I have no idea where he got this from, but claimed that Zelensky's approval rating in Ukraine is at 4%, which the latest survey that I saw put it at 57%. So just a little bit off there. And so they've been going back and forth for the last couple of days. Zelensky's been more kind of expressing disappointment, accusing Trump or, you know, kind of shaking his head and saying Trump is living inside a disinformation bubble and isn't this awful, not really criticizing him as harshly and personally as Trump is criticizing Zelensky. But nevertheless, it has devolved into basically like a slap fight between these two guys, which is great news. I mean, if you want sober leadership and an actual path to ending the war. Zelensky has already said that he'll reject any deal that's done without Ukrainian involvement. I don't know what grounds he's going to have to do that, since the United States is the money machine here as far as the Ukrainian military is concerned, or the weapons and money machine. If the U.S. says this is over, you know, here's the deal, I'm not sure how much leverage Zelensky has. He can appeal to European countries, but European countries are every bit as dependent, amazingly, because this is like we're into year 20 of this discourse about how Europe should cut its dependency on the U.S., but still just as dependent on the U.S. as ever. They're not going to be able to do very much to help him if the U.S. decides that this is the end of the line. So, you know, I don't know how he's going to avoid accepting whatever deal Trump negotiates. But we'll, you know, as always, we'll see. Time will tell.
Speaking of deals, let's talk about this Telegraph report on the U.S. mineral rights deal that Zelensky has already rejected.
This is fascinating. We've heard about this over the last few weeks, that Trump was interested. Apparently, Zelensky last year had visited him. I don't know, paid an homage at Mar-a-Lago or wherever you go on your pilgrimage to see Trump, and had broached the idea of the U.S. getting a portion of Ukraine's mineral resources, either as an investment or, you know, rights to purchase the minerals. And Ukraine does have some amount of like rare earth minerals. There's some gas deposits, oil deposits. There are some things that are of value under the soil in Ukraine. Nobody really knows how valuable it is. You see figures bandied around in the hundreds of billions of dollars. And Trump came away from that meeting with Zelensky apparently convinced that there was $500 billion to be made for the United States if it got in on this mineral rights deal. All the surveys of, you know, what's there and how much it's worth are based on very old and probably inaccurate Soviet era surveys of the mineral resources. They're also
how dare
based,
you insult yeah, the Soviet I know. Engineers who did this?
You know, I mean, they were working with older technology. I get it. It's not their fault. But anyway, and they're also apparently what I've seen or read of this. They're based on some really weird and wildly overvalued estimates of what some of this stuff is worth. Like there's some metals that aren't really that valuable anymore. Like they used to be at one point, pretty important to, you know, battery manufacture, that type of thing. And they're not anymore, but the Ukrainians or the people who look at these things are still valuing it, valuing those metals as if they are important and valuable. So it's a little bit murky how much is actually there. But regardless of that, Trump thinks he's going to get $500 billion out of this. And so that's the figure that we're operating with. Apparently, he sent Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent to Ukraine earlier this month and proposed. Bessent carried with him a deal that would have essentially made Ukraine an economic colony in the United States, according to this piece in The Telegraph by Ambrose Evans Pritchard, who says he got a draft copy of the agreement. It would have like given the U.S. a 50% cut of all Ukrainian mineral revenues and priority in payments. So the U.S. would have gotten its money before Ukraine got dollar one, theoretically. It would have had right of first refusal to buy those future mineral products, you know, heavy control over the Ukrainian economy in other ways. And the kicker, I think, is that this figure of $500 billion is locked in. It seems like it's locked into this draft. And there's a question then hanging over, and there's some vague language around this of what the United States would be entitled to do or to acquire in Ukraine if that $500 billion expectation was not met. And that could be quite severe, especially if, as I say, the valuations are wrong and there is not $500 billion to be made here.
Derek, this reminds me of those deals like singers would make with major labels in like 1953. Yes, it's like they sign really away is. All of like, their songs.
I mean, it is.
Eternity.
It's like you got to, you know, Luca Brasi has a gun to your head and, you know, you got to sign the deal or else. So, you know, Zelensky obviously said no. I think him saying no is probably part of the reason why he had nothing to do with these talks on Tuesday in Saudi Arabia, and part of the reason why Trump is once again so angry at him. They may still revisit this and try to work out a deal, and it's still probably Ukraine's best way of keeping Trump interested in supporting Ukraine for the long haul. Is the possibility of, you know, windfall profit for Trump or for the U.S. I'm not sure he sees a distinction between the two at this point. So, yeah, I mean, I think this will be a thing that continues to be discussed. But clearly this opening salvo was just not acceptable to the Ukrainians.
Thanks, Derek. Let's move on to Israel-Palestine and let's talk about last week's hostage exchange on Saturday, which was successful.
We talked last week about the controversies that had emerged. Hamas was early last week said it wasn't going to proceed with the hostage exchange, that it was going to postpone, suspend them indefinitely because of Israeli violations of the what really are Israeli violations, it seems, of the ceasefire agreement, in particular in terms of the amount of aid coming in to Gaza and the type of aid that's being allowed to come in.
The three men were released a short time ago, paraded on stage, as has become the custom during these hostage handovers in Gaza. Their appearance far better than the last lot of hostages who were freed last weekend. But here in Hostage Square in Tel Aviv, there was clapping as the three men were brought out of the vehicles and handed over to the International Red Cross.
The exchange finally, after some kind of a flurry of diplomatic activity, you know, heavy negotiations, by the end of the week, it was clear that the exchange was going to take place, and it did take place on Saturday as scheduled. So the ceasefire or truce or whatever you want to call it will survive for another week. the negotiations, supposedly, I still haven't seen any indication that this has happened, but it's supposedly we've gotten from every corner, the mediators, Israel, Hamas, that the negotiations on the second phase of the ceasefire agreement, which would be an actual ceasefire, actually see the Israeli military withdraw from Gaza, see an indefinite end to hostilities, and the release of all the remaining October 7th hostages, plus some number of Palestinian detainees in Israeli custody. Those negotiations were supposed to finally begin this week. They're like 3 weeks late at this point because the Israelis just simply don't have any interest in negotiating. And I think even when they do engage, it's going to be to try and prevent a deal rather than reach one. I still don't know if those have started. Maybe they haven't, at this point. But we're very late in the process. There's only supposed to be two more weeks of this, two more exchanges were scheduled. And this is where we get into the thing that Hamas offered later in the week after Saturday's release. They offered to speed up the process. So on Tuesday, Hamas announced that it was basically rolling the last two exchanges, or the last two hostage releases under the first phase truce deal, into one release, and they will release six hostages this coming Saturday instead of three. They also announced that they were going to release the bodies of four deceased hostages, including the two youngest of them, the two Biba's children, which they did do on Thursday. I haven't really had a chance to see any reporting on that, but it did take place before we recorded. The speeding up, the expedited schedule appears to be attempting to do a couple of things. One, Hamas supposedly, there have been reports to this effect, that believes that the Israelis are not just looking to not negotiate a second phase of the ceasefire, but they're planning on ending the first phase early and just returning to the obliteration of Gaza. And there were some particularly sensitive Hamas-affiliated detainees who are in Israeli custody who are supposed to be released in the final exchange of this round of the ceasefire, or this phase of the ceasefire, that they wanted to ensure would be released. And so moving things up a week, in their minds, attempts at least to secure their release before the Israelis get around to tearing up the deal. Some other considerations here. I think the mediators, the Egyptians and the Qataris, both view this offer to speed things up as a way to generate maybe some goodwill with the Israelis as far as those second phase negotiations are concerned. Again, I don't think it matters very much, but that's one thing that's on the table. Also, it seems the Israelis have agreed in relation to the announcement of this sped up process that they would finally let some of this aid into Gaza that they've been restricting, basically mobile homes for displaced persons and heavy machinery to clear rubble. Both to clear the land and to kind of search for the bodies of people who are still trapped under, or whose bodies are still under the rubble that the IDF has left there. So that's where things stand. Again, I don't know if that's taken place either. And that's also weeks old. Like, the Israelis should have allowed that stuff in weeks ago under the terms of the ceasefire deal, and they've just refused to do that. The other announcement that Hamas made, this was on Wednesday, again, in sort of an expedited schedule idea, they offered to release all of their remaining hostages, all of the remaining hostages in Gaza, in one fell swoop, basically, if there is a second phase negotiated to the ceasefire deal. So it would not proceed, that phase would not proceed the way this one has, with these kind of staged releases every week, three here, three there. It would be all of them at once. This is, again, meant to, I think, sweeten the pot for the Israelis, or at least to create a more public pressure on the Israeli government to negotiate in good faith, which is something, it still doesn't seem inclined to do. But the idea is, I think, to appeal to the Israeli people and say, look, all these hostages can come home right away without this, kind of games playing or dancing around it. They can all come home right away if there's a deal. You just have to lean on your government to make one. I'm not optimistic. Every report I've seen still says Benjamin Netanyahu does not want a second round of this ceasefire. He wants to end it and get back to destroying Gaza and implementing now the Trump, the glorious Trump plan to ethnically cleanse the territory and turn it into a luxury resort colony.
Very, very depressing stuff. Let's stay in the region and let's talk about Israel, which appears to be ignoring its withdrawal deadline in Lebanon.
Incredibly. I mean, I really thought they were going to leave this time. No, the deadline was Tuesday. This was had already been extended once from the end of January for the Israelis to be out of southern Lebanon, according to the ceasefire deal that they agreed to with Hezbollah back in November. This has been telegraphed for a while that the Israelis would not meet even this extended deadline. They are retaining control over five strategic high points, basically along the border. They did withdraw from the rest of the region, at least theoretically, which does, in theory, open up the region for the most important thing here, which is getting people who have been displaced by this conflict back into whatever is left of their homes, whatever the IDF is left of them. That said, I mean, as long as there are Israeli forces in southern Lebanon, I don't think it's safe for these people to be returning to their villages, because the Israelis have shown no compunction about certainly shooting first and asking questions later or never. So this is still a pretty dangerous situation, and it's going to continue to be one until the Israelis actually leave. They're claiming now that they want to hold on to these strategic points until the Lebanese military is able to move in and take them over and prevent Hezbollah from returning to these places. I'm not sure that's anything more than an excuse. The Lebanese government wants Israel out. It's appealed to France and the U.S., the two supposed guarantors of the November ceasefire, to basically force Israel to comply with its terms. There's been no inclination that that's going to happen. Certainly the Trump administration is not going to force this issue. And I don't think France has any real ground to do so.
Another, how dare you? How dare you insult our great French friends?
So this is probably going to go on for a while. I think they haven't even articulated, unlike the last time this got extended in, as I said, late January, when it was definitely extended for 3 weeks. There's no new deadline that I've seen. There's no indication of when they actually might withdraw, which leads me to believe they're not going to withdraw. We'll see how it goes.
Yeah, this is
going
to go on for several years, it seems, at the very least. Let's move over to East Asia, and let's talk about the State Department changing wording on its fact sheet with regards to Taiwan.
This seems like a very picayune thing, but it's in the realm of diplomacy where picayune things matter. The U.S. State Department, at some point in the last couple of weeks, this was noticed by Taiwanese media over the weekend, changed the language on its relations with Taiwan fact sheet to remove the language, "We do not support Taiwan independence." So that's excised completely. The fact sheet still retains language that says the U.S. opposes what it calls any unilateral changes to the status quo between Taiwan and China, which presumably would include a declaration of independence from Taiwan. But the removal of the "we do not support Taiwan independence" language has been caused a bit of a stir. As I say, it was reported somewhat gleefully in Taiwanese media. There's also language in there now suggesting that the U.S. would support Taiwan's application for membership in various international organizations, some of which the United States has quit, like the WHO, but other organizations like that, where Taiwan is permitted observer status at best because it's not recognized as an independent country. And the Chinese government would regards any sort of talk of Taiwanese membership in organizations like that as de facto kind of statements of independence. So as you might expect, this did not go over well in Beijing. Spokesperson for the Chinese Foreign Ministry on Monday, after the story broke, demanded that the U.S., quoting here, "stop emboldening and supporting Taiwan independence and avoid further damaging China-U.S. relations and the peace and stability of the Taiwan Strait." So they're not happy. It's unclear what the point of this change was. The U.S. did this actually before, in 2022, made this same change, apparently, removing the language about Taiwan independence and reinstated it within a couple of weeks because the Chinese response was so negative. I don't know whether the Trump administration is going to be as sensitive to that as the Biden administration was. But it, again, it's it, we don't you don't know if this is just sort of a little like tweak, a thumb in the eye. You know, we're not really trying to say anything profound, but, you know, we wanted to make a little bit of a statement, or if this really meaningfully changes U.S. policy toward China and Taiwan. It's unclear from just this language. And I haven't seen any comment from the Trump administration. So who knows?
You are a very important person. You show up, put in the work, and bring your best to each and every day. It isn't always glamorous or easy, but it's worth it because you're building a life for yourself and those you love. That means a lot, and so do you. When you open an account at Park National Bank, you get more than you might expect. Your own personal banker and the VIP treatment you deserve. Park National Bank, where you mean more. Member FDIC.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And Future Stronger You can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See home club for details.
Let's stay in the region. Let's talk about South Korea, where Yoon is going to trial.
Setting another dubious historical precedent. Yoon Suk-yeol, the president of South Korea, on Thursday became the first sitting South Korean president to face a criminal trial over his brief foray into dictatorship back in December when he declared martial law, only to rescind it 6 hours later amid parliamentary and popular opposition. As you may recall, South Korean authorities arrested Yoon last month. He's been charged with insurrection, which in theory could get him anything up to and including a life sentence in prison or even execution. I think that's probably not going to happen, but it is, you know, a possibility with those charges. So yeah, I mean, he's breaking, trailblazing new ground every day at this point. So good for him. His impeachment case is still being heard by the South Korean Constitutional Court. There was another.
I think he's got a
hearing.
Good chance. I think
think. Yeah, he's things are going great for him. They were supposed to hold another hearing on Thursday. I don't know how many more hearings the court needs before the judges are going to be ready to deliberate and decide whether to uphold the impeachment or rescind it. It's really unclear. Once they finally do take the case, the precedent here in past similar impeachment cases has been about 2 weeks, anywhere from 10 days to 2 weeks, that they'll be kind of in the back room hashing it out before they finally issue a ruling. But again, they have to get to the end of the trial, and I don't know if they're there yet.
Well, we will keep a close eye on that. Let's move over to Sudan, where the RSF has attempted to form a government, and predictably, controversy has ensued.
Shockingly, yes. The Rapid Support Forces group held a pretty swanky-looking event in Nairobi, the capital of Kenya, on Tuesday. This was supposed to be a ceremony, I think, announcing the formation of a new government in the areas of Sudan that are under RSF control. The deputy leader of the Rapid Support Forces, Abdurrahim Dagalo, the brother of Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, the commander of the RSF, was there. He was the main attendee. And the plan, I think, the plan from the reporting I've seen, the plan was to sign a charter for the new government at this event on Tuesday. They did not wind up doing that. There are negotiations still going on between the RSF and the leader of one faction of the rebel Sudan People's Liberation Movement North, Abdulaziz Al-Hilu, over the nature of the charter and what's going to be in it and the content and how the government's going to function. Hilu, who has until this point kind of ridden the fence in this conflict and you know, not thrown in with either the RSF or the Sudanese military, now seems to be working with the RSF, but was apparently not happy enough with where the charter was at for them to go ahead with the signing ceremony. So instead, they just had this kind of coming attractions, I think, centered summit or conference or event in Nairobi to kind of preview what was going to happen. And the plan still is, I think, to form a government of some kind. Now, as you say, Danny, controversy ensued here, first and foremost, between the internationally recognized Sudanese government, which is tied to the military, and the Kenyan government. The Sudanese government accused Kenya of having committed something tantamount to an act of hostility, that's a quote, in deciding to host the RSF event. The Kenyan foreign ministry had to insist on Wednesday that it's taking no position in the Sudan civil war, the Sudan conflict. It supports peace only. It's not picking a side. That said, Dagalo, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, the RSF commander, and William Ruto, the president of Kenya, are apparently on pretty friendly terms with one another. And so, you know, I think he has, Ruto probably has picked a side, even if he's not willing to just come out and say so. The other bit of fallout here involves the Tagadum movement, which is a civilian coalition. It is the largest civilian political entity connected to Sudan. It's led by the former prime minister, Abdullah Hamdok, who is in exile after having been removed from that job by the military and RSF back before they started fighting each other when they were just trying to fight any sort of civilian government. His organization kind of collects, or it's a coalition of political parties, it's of NGOs, human rights groups, doctors, you know, unions, kind of, you know, all these same civil society groups, who are opposed to the war on principle, that they haven't, you know, taken aside. They're just opposed to the war. They want the conflict to end. Hamdok has been accused of working with the RSF in the past, but the coalition, Tagadum, has fragmented over, again, this RSF plan to form its own government. There is a faction within Tagadum that I think is comprised mainly of civil society actors and political parties who are located in these, again, parts of Sudan that are controlled by the RSF, that has decided to go along with the formation of this government. Hamdok and the rest of the movement have refused to countenance the formation of an RSF-led government. And so they have splintered. This could have serious impacts in terms of, you know, a future settlement to this conflict, because Tagadum probably would have served as the basis for some kind of interim government. I mean, it's organized well enough to, I think, have stepped into that role in the event of an actual move towards some semblance of civilian government. Not that that's necessarily going to happen, but there are potential repercussions here complicating a settlement to the conflict as a result of this dissolution.
And we will keep an eye on it. Let's turn to the DRC, where M23 and with Rwanda have taken Bukavu, and basically they're continuing to advance north and south.
Yes, the M23 and Rwandan soldiers entered Bukavu over the weekend. There were indications that they had entered the outskirts of the city. Bukavu is the capital of South Kivu province. It's the second largest city in the eastern DRC after Goma, which M23 already controls. There were indications that they had entered the outskirts of Bukavu on Friday. Over the weekend, it became clear that they were in control of the city. They've now started to sort of consolidate their position and establish some kind of rudimentary level of governance. There was a period over the weekend of reportedly total chaos, a lot of looting and people fleeing the city. Those people who fled the city included Congolese security forces, Congolese military, and the Burundian military, which is now reportedly leaving the country altogether, withdrawing altogether in the face of this offensive, which just seems you know, to be on a roll at this point. As you said, they're continuing to advance. There were reports this week that they're advancing in two directions. They're moving on the city of Butembo, which is located in the northern part of North Kivu province. It's about 200 or so kilometers north of Goma, and is a pretty important commercial hub. From what I could tell, they weren't meeting much resistance as they sort of, you know, worked their way through on the road from Goma to Butembo. capturing, you know, towns and villages along the way. There's also indications that M23 and Rwanda are moving south from Bukavu. The next big city that they may be targeting is the city of Uvira, which is located on the border and is another kind of commercial hub. It's also where, as I say, these Burundian forces, there have been thousands of Burundian soldiers in the DRC fighting M23 for years now. Many of them seem to have massed here as they wait for evacuation by the Burundian government to get out of the way. But those two cities, Butembo and Uvira, seem to be the next two targets.
Let's move over to the Western Hemisphere, and let's start with Argentina, where style icon and Argentine leader Javier Milei has been accused of a rug pull.
Yeah, this is only in 2025, I guess. Javier Milei, and don't ask me to explain this because I don't know how any of this shit works, but he promoted a meme coin, something called Libra, on social media, and said that it was... In his post, said that it was dedicated to encouraging the growth of the Argentine economy, and I guess got a lot of people to invest in this thing. Drove the coin's price from almost nothing to around $5. At which point, all of the whales who were in on the coin when it was zero just sold their shares, all their coins, and crashed the price back down to almost zero, and lost, I think, $280 million of value was taken out of this thing, was the number that I saw. So yeah, just a straight up rug pull, like just a complete fraud. Milei has denied, he went back and deleted his post promoting this thing, or any post that he had promoting this coin, and now says he really had nothing to do with it. He was just, you know, paid to promote it, I guess, or something like that. But it's not his fault if people invested and lost everything. He's under investigation. This could wind up with him facing impeachment. I don't think it'd be successful in the Congress, but he could actually face some serious charges here. I just think it's incredible that we have sitting heads of state rug pulling people on cryptocurrency. Obviously we've always had corruption, we've always had scandals. It just seems so much dumber now than it ever used to be. Sorry.
I don't know. I just think it's the free market working as a free market should. Let's conclude on the greatest country on earth, and that is, of course, the United States, where President Donald Trump and his buddy Elon Musk have fired National Nuclear Security Administration workers without fully knowing what these workers do.
Yeah, speaking of people who are doing a confidence job, Trump and Musk, the Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, which isn't a real department, I'm not sure what it is, frankly, late Thursday night fired, and we talked about this in our Q&A, actually, if people want to see it. I mentioned this briefly in our Q&A, if people haven't looked at that. But on Thursday night, they fired over 300 staffers from the National Nuclear Security Administration. These were all probationary employees. And they're just basically, I mean, this is part and parcel of what they're doing. They're going around to almost every office at this point, one by one, and firing all the probationary employees, because the probationary employees haven't been in the government long enough to get civil service protection. So it's easy to fire them. And they're just like hacking away at stuff to get rid of government workers, because they hate government workers. And so they did this in the NNSA, only to then find out, I guess, having not known this beforehand, that the National Nuclear Security Administration manages the U.S. nuclear arsenal, and that some of the people that they had fired were responsible for writing requirements and guidelines for the contractors who build nuclear weapons. Others were on the ground at facilities. This is according to CNN, on the ground at facilities where nuclear weapons are built to oversee the building of the nuclear weapons and inspecting them after they've been built. So some pretty critical stuff. Like, you would not want uninspected nuclear weapons kind of, just sitting there festering in case there was something wrong with them. So they had to hurriedly rescind these termination notices. They apparently spent much of the weekend desperately trying to do this because they didn't have, for many of these hundreds of people they fired, they didn't have a way to contact them, having already frozen and deleted maybe even their government email accounts. They couldn't contact them that way. So they were scrambling to figure out how to contact these people. They wound up, I think, getting most of them back. The Department of Energy now says that they fired fewer than 50 employees, and these were confined to sort of administrative and clerical positions rather than, you know, anything like an on-the-ground inspector or somebody who's actually writing substance here. But many of the ones who've gone back, NBC News spoke to a few of them. Of course, you know, the ones they spoke to all seemed to suggest that they were going to be looking for other work now. Like, they were not going to be staying in the government for any extended period of time, having been treated this way and having to now worry about their future employment security. They were going to go looking elsewhere for jobs. So they may not be there. Even the ones who were brought back, whose termination were rescinded, may not be there for very long. And I just think it's good that we're just firing people without even really knowing what job they do. That seems like a real recipe for success.
Soon planes will be crashing into nuclear facilities.
Yes, they've gone into the FAA too. So if they give them the same treatment, this should all work out just fantastically.
Well, let's end on this pretty interesting issue with maybe Trump is going to cut the defense budget.
The Washington Post reported on a memo that it says it has obtained. It reported on Wednesday, a memo in which Pete Hegseth, the defense secretary, has ordered, and I'm quoting here from the Post, has ordered senior leaders at the Pentagon and throughout the U.S. military to develop plans for cutting 8% from the defense budget in each of the next 5 years. Now, if that's true, that would be a pretty significant cut. I mean, for a military budget that never does anything but get bigger, any cut is significant. But this is like a pretty meaningful bite out of the military budget. I'm sure you have some thoughts about this, Danny. My suspicion is that this is not going to happen, at least not in the way that it's being described right now, that any cuts that they do identify are going to be probably socked back into other boondoggles, like Donald Trump wants to build an Iron Dome system for the United States, as asinine as that sounds, as ridiculous as it may be, but he's going to need money for that. And I think rather than just cutting from the defense budget and shrinking it, if they do find 8% in cuts in each of the next 5 years, that money's going to get socked into this other boondoggle horseshit missile defense project. My other suspicion is that the places that they're going to try to find these cuts, there's just not going to be that much money there. Like, this is a group of people who probably think the Pentagon spends $500 billion a year on diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, and all they have to do is eliminate that and they'll save, and another like $250 billion on climate programs or some bullshit, and all they have to do is like chunk that stuff out and they've saved, you know, billions of dollars. I'm sure that's not the case. And so, you know, if they look in those places to cut and are unwilling to explore, I don't know, terminating the F-35 program or something like that, then, you know, I don't think they're going to find the level of cuts that they're looking for. At that point, if they don't find it in the DEI stuff or they don't find it in climate, my concern is that they would turn on like uniform personnel. And there are things you could do like cutting commissaries and facilities on military bases that would greatly, heavily impact like land on enlisted personnel who don't make that much money to begin with. These are in many cases subsidies essentially for those people who struggle to make ends meet and you know take services from the base where they can. If those services get cut, it's you know going to land disproportionately on the least paid people in the Defense Department. So those are the things that I would. Those are the thoughts that I had as I was reading this.
I think that's probably correct. And that's actually something we should maybe address on our Q&A. So people, please sign up to our YouTube page, link in the show notes. Please consider subscribing to the show. We really can't do it without you. Please consider liking it. Please consider reviewing it. And also join the Discord, which is getting livelier and livelier. So as always, thank you all for listening and keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger. And Future Stronger You can get started now by saving $28 or more when you join today. You in? We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need to keep stepping it up. And free fitness training to help you mix up your routine. Plus, most clubs are open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more. Just $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends February 28th. See home club for details.
Why choose a Sleep Number smart bed?
Can I make my side softer?
Can I make my side firmer?
Can we sleep cooler?
Sleep Number does that. Cools up to 8 times faster and lets you choose your ideal comfort on either side. Your Sleep Number setting. And now, save 50% on the new Sleep Number limited edition smart bed. Limited time. Exclusively at a Sleep Number store near you. Learn more at sleepnumber.com.